At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with return guest, social media icon, Hillel Fuld. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I could continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. Hillel Fuld is nothing if not outspoken. His tweets on X have had billions of views in the last 18 months since October 7th, and he's been extremely instrumental in informing and enlightening the world on the realities of the war in Gaza and the state of the Jewish state. From the ceasefire and hostage deal to Benjamin Netanyahu and the future of democracy, to judicial reform protests and the deep state, Hillel is at the forefront of it all, deconstructing, elucidating, educating, commentating, and sometimes really pissing people off. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Hillel Fuld back to the Yoga of War podcast to discuss what's going on in Israel today, what's going on with the Israel-Hamas war, and what the future holds for each side. And Abyssal of Torah. If you are confused about the popular uprisings within Israel, you owe it to yourself to listen to this discussion about what the people of Israel and the state of Israel each stand for and the complexities that, despite it all, will forever bind the two. Dubbed Israel's top marketer, journalist, and social influencer, Hillel Fuld works with leading tech entrepreneurs, investors, and visionaries to accompany them on their journey from idea to revenue. Since the war began on October 7th, Hillel has been dedicated to utilizing his skills, team, connections, and abilities to promote the positive message of Israel and the Jewish people in combating anti-Semitism through social engagement. Thank you, Hillel, for bringing your unique insight back to the show.
I have to say, that was a really, really nice way of saying that I have a big mouth.
Not fingers.
my teachers always told me I had a big mouth, and that, you know, if I don't keep my mouth shut, but it turns out I built a career out of having a big mouth.
Yeah, please don't keep your mouth shut. Before we get into the sticks of what's happening in Israeli society today, let's talk about something that everyone can really relate to, which is the hostages and the fraught negotiations to get them home. Back in January, when phase one of the ceasefire was announced, you were quite emphatic and still are in your support to get any and all hostages home, particularly the Bibas babies, Ariel and Kfir. Then, in a perfect depiction of the humanistic complexities of this entire war, it turned out that the terrorist who murdered your brother, Ari, would be released from prison as part of that exchange. What's more, your eldest son is currently serving in the IDF and your second son is soon to enter. So ceasefire also has broad implications for you and your family, not to mention the basic truth of being an Israeli citizen and grappling with the reality of Hamas terrorists threatening a lifetime of October 7th should they remain in power in Gaza. I can only imagine the excruciating whirlwind of overpowering mixed emotions that engulfed you in that moment. So I was wondering if you could share with us some of your, like, the entangled feelings about phase one of the deal and also how you made peace with it.
So I think it's important to understand that, contrary to what most people would believe on the internet, specifically on social media, life is not black and white. Right. I mean, on social media, you know, you're either the devil or the hero. You're either the villain or the hero. Right. And there's no middle ground. Like, you'll never hear someone say, I don't know, I don't like Donald Trump's personality, but I think he's an amazing president. Or I think Joe Biden's a really nice guy, but I don't like him as president. No, either the devil, or, you know, like, so that's not real life. And real life is gray. There are some things that are black and white. Good and evil is black and white. Hamas is evil. That's black and white. But this hostage deal isn't anything but black and white. And again, both sides of the argument like to present it as if it is black and white, but it isn't. And now this is me speaking not as an Israel advocate or a whatever you want to call me, but as a brother, a bereaved brother, who's the terrorist of my brother was released in this deal. And, you know, you might expect me to say, oh, my God, it's the most horrible thing in the world. It is the most horrible thing in the world, but it's also the most beautiful thing in the world, because one might say that Ari saved lives in his life. He saved lives in his death. And now he's saving lives long after he's left us. So, you know, to see these families reunited is the most beautiful thing in the world. So, you know, letting these monsters go is horrible. Bringing these people home is beautiful. It's nuanced.
Wow. Now I want to cry.
Already?
Yeah. Last time I didn't actually cry, but I remember I was having these cough attacks and like trying to hold them in, made it look like I was crying. But I'm thinking about my sister-in-law, who isn't really my sister-in-law, it's my brother-in-law's sister, who died a very shocking and sudden death, but that her organs saved six lives. And wow. So said that it really just sort of it we the complexities of life and how it all intertwines, it you can't pull a thread out of a sweater, right, without pulling apart the sweater. And wow, thank you. That was a lot more concise than I was expecting it to be. Okay, so meanwhile, we've got, you know, you never know from the media and angles and whatever, but it seems like tons or maybe even hundreds of thousands of protesters that have been filling the streets of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv throughout Israel, calling on Netanyahu to get the remaining hostages home at any cost. Now, any human being can sympathize with the unmitigated torture and anguish that the hostage families must be going through right now, especially in light of reports from released hostages about the barbaric and inconceivably cruel treatment the remaining hostages are experiencing. But at the same time, there's an impossibly painful reality that securing the hostages' release at all costs will cost thousands of times more Israeli lives in the long, or quite honestly, even in the short run, than the 20 to 25 lives it would save. And this is such an impossible calculus. I don't want to be redundant because everybody's saying it, but we learned this from Gilad Shalit. 1,027 prisoners, including Yahya Sinwar, the mastermind of 10/7, exchanged for one Israeli hostage. So while it's impossible, and we shouldn't, to judge these families for their desperation to get their loved ones home, what would be the actual cost of releasing the hostages at any cost?
So, I mean, let's just start from the beginning and say that I guess I should give a disclaimer and say that anything I'm going to say from here on out is totally my opinion. Some of it's going to be maybe controversial, maybe even offensive, but this is what I believe. And I believe that those protests that you referenced in the beginning of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets, I'm sorry, but what are you protesting? You don't think we want the hostages back? You don't think Netanyahu wants the hostages back? What are you protesting? You think you want the protest the hostages back better, more than anyone else? We all want the hostages back. What are you protesting about? But the answer is they've unfortunately hijacked that agenda to take their anti-BB protests, which has been the case for who knows how long, years, that keeps evolving, keeps taking on a new shape, right? I mean, it was the cigars that he took, and then it was COVID, and then how he handled COVID, and then it was, you know, the deal that he won't sign, and then it was the deal that he did sign, and it was the judicial reform, and it was like, no matter, they won't stop. And so now this new thing is like, oh, let's make Bibi look bad by saying he doesn't want the hostages out. Do me a favor. You cannot like Bibi. I didn't even vote for Bibi, but do me a favor. The guy lost his brother to the state of Israel. The guy's dedicated his life to the state of Israel. The guy's endured endless personal attacks on his family for decades. Trust me, he does not need this, okay? He wants the hostages back. He wants to lead this country. He wants to win this war. And anybody who says otherwise is being dishonest at best. So, you know, the issue itself, again, is super-duper complex, not black and white. Yeah, I mean, and you really, I think you nailed it. In other words, we don't have, this isn't a philosophical discussion, right? You are saving one life and you are putting 1,000 lives in danger, right? Because every one of those terrorists that we're releasing, for those 59 hostages that I want back like anyone else wants back, each one of those terrorists, no one is kidding themselves to think that they're going to leave Israeli prison and not go back to terror. That's exactly what they're going to do. I mean, history shows that. So yes, I want these hostages back. Yes, it breaks my heart that they're enduring what they're enduring. I don't even want to imagine what they're going through in Gaza and the dungeons of hell over there. And I want to do everything I can to bring them back. But we also have to think responsibly as a country. And I'm not, by the way, to be clear, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I'm just thanking God that I'm not in Netanyahu's shoes to have to make this decision. You know, but the reality is the flip side, and that, you know, a very fundamental pillar of Judaism is returning our prisoners, bringing our hostages back. So, you know, you can't make that calculation on the one hand. The other hand, you have to make that calculation. So it's this cognitive dissonance, that this internal conflict that everyone feels, that I think is a pretty regular phenomenon in the Middle East. People living in Israel always have that conflict about everything, right? You know, on the one hand, we want peace. On the other hand, what do we do for peace? It's just a nonstop conflict, you know, and even with my brother, you know, on the one hand, tremendous tragedy on a personal level, but also tremendous pride because he's a national hero of the state of Israel. It's just, you know, no one said it's going to be easy living in the Middle East, but it is just a constant cognitive dissonance. No other way to describe it.
But it also goes beyond the prisoner exchange. It's funny that you go straight there, because I go straight to disengagement in Gaza and allowing them to rebuild.
Right.
To me, that's like the bigger overarching threat, because, you know, ultimately, if terrorists go back to terrorism, they can wind up and probably will wind up imprisoned again, right? Like, so that cycle, I feel like, is sort of the micro. But the macro is what happens if we're like, okay, ceasefire, end of war. And by the way, Israel has never started a war. So we're expected to have a permanent and lasting ceasefire with international guarantees, but doesn't matter what they do. So what does disengagement, like the whole thing, like where does it go?
So, you know, I've spoken about this, and I think we spoke about it last time also. The lies, the dishonesty runs so deep, right? I mean, you mentioned disengagement. 2005, Israel left Gaza. There was not a single Jew in Gaza on October 6th. What occupation? Oh, they attacked because of occupation? There was not a single Jew in Gaza. Israel left, forcefully removed 10,000 of its citizens from Gaza communities, dug up our dead so that Hamas wouldn't mutilate dead bodies. And we took every single Jew out of Gaza. We gave it to them on a silver platter and said, here, make the state that the world says you want so badly. Here, make a state. And they turned it into a terror base. Like, what are we talking about here? Like, the lies, it's, on the one hand, it's, you know, it's infuriating. On the other hand, it's comical. Like, how are people saying that we were occupying Gaza? This isn't a discussion. This isn't a debate. This isn't an opinion. It's a fact, an undeniable, indisputable fact. We were not in Gaza on October 6th. Not a single soldier, not a single Jew. But the lies are just so deep. And the reason they're so deep is because the very identity of the Palestinian people is one big lie. And I'm sorry, I know that some people listening are going to be upset about that, but if this upsets you, then just answer the following question. When was this Arab-Palestinian state that we occupied established? Who was the prime minister? Name me a single name of a Palestinian leader before Yasser Arafat declared or founded the PLO in 1964. Since the Palestinians, presumably they have this, you know, thousands and thousands of years of history in the land, name me one single name a Palestinian leader. The answer is it doesn't exist, because such a nation never existed, such a country never existed. But when you base your entire identity, right, on a lie, in 1964 there was no so-called occupation. So what was the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, liberating? What were they liberating? There was no occupation. They were liberating all of Israel. They wanted every inch of Israel. That's what they want till today. They don't want a state. And the lies are just nonstop. And again, on the one hand, I want to bang my head in the wall. On the other hand, it's like, really? Like, you're an intelligent person and this is your opinion? Like, it, so you got to laugh. Either cry or laugh. So I choose to laugh.
It does make for some pretty good memes. So I guess that, like, just watching, I don't even know what to call them, negotiations. I don't even know if negotiations are even going on anymore. They are, they're not, they are, they're not, 1 minute, whatever. It's so frustrating, to say the least. And the reports, like, every time I see a report of even a proposal, I'm like, really, dribs and drabs again? Like we just started this maximum pressure campaign, and we're like, oh, but let's give back the aid, and oh, let's renegotiate for five hostages. And it's like, do you see any scenario where every hostage is actually released? Can Israel, like, keep their feet to the fire for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're doing now is actually brilliant, and it's something that we should have done a long time ago, which is simply annexing Gaza. You don't give us our hostages back, you lose land. That's all they care about. They don't care about dead Palestinians. We know that, and they use them as human shields. They hide underground. They don't care about dead Palestinians. In fact, they leverage dead Palestinians as a PR move. So they don't care about dead Palestinians. That's not going to work. What we're doing now is taking land, and they absolutely do care about that. So, you know, if as long as we keep going at this, I truly do believe that there's going to be a resolution soon. Hamas is, they know they're against the wall. They know, I mean, listen, I don't want to jinx anything, but, you know, I have many people in Gaza right now that tell me they're just hiding like little cockroaches underground. They're not, you know, they're not fighting, they're not doing anything. And so I do believe that if the IDF continues, Israel continues to annex land in Gaza, sooner or later, unless they're, I mean, truth is, we are dealing with insane people, such deep indoctrination that they might never give up. But, you know, if anything's going to make them, if anything's going to apply pressure to them, I believe it's the loss of land.
First of all, I actually agree with you. My question was, is Israel, like, if Israel is like, okay, like, we'll, for 11 hostages, we'll go back to 42 days of ceasefire. Like, didn't we already, like, first of all, how do we pick and choose a life? Like, this guy gets to live, this guy gets to stay. It makes me physically ill. It just feels like if we just maintain the maximum pressure, and listen, the world is already going to vilify us no matter what we do. So maintain this pressure, the annexation, the blocking of aid, all the things, until all 59 hostages are home. Is that feasible?
I hope so. I mean, I don't know what's going on behind closed doors in terms of pressure. I know that Trump wants to end the war, but he wants to bring the hostages back. So I hope and pray that he continues to be a friend to Israel and let Israel do what it needs to do and doesn't handcuff us like Biden did. But to say that I know what's going on, I don't know what's going on behind closed doors. I want to believe and I want to hope that that's what we will continue to do.
Okay. So, this weekend, of course, we're starting the holiday of Passover, and thank you for joining the show on such a erev as this. We use this holiday to celebrate the exodus of the Jews from Egypt, and obviously to the chants of let my people go. So let me ask you, what are the lessons of the Haggadah, the book of the Seder that we read, that ring truer today than in any year past?
Well, first of all, let's start with the end, and that is that we celebrate Passover today, and it's this happy day, just like the rest of our holidays, Purim and Hanukkah. But if you step out of our little world here, our little entitled Western world, and think about the actual events of Passover, where this nation, the Israelites, were enslaved and persecuted and tortured for 210 years of backbreaking slavery, and today we celebrate. And so it's important to remember that we celebrate Purim. We don't realize that Purim back then was the near genocide of the Jewish people. And we celebrate Hanukkah, and that was a war we were not going to win. And so it's important to remember that while we're in this war right now, and we're devastated, and we're mourning, and we're losing all these, you know, precious souls, we will dance again. We will celebrate Simchas Torah again, like we do all our other holidays. That's first and foremost. But also, there's so many things about the story of Passover that are just so, it's like deja vu or something. It's a crazy thing because, first of all, you know, the Torah actually says this. You know, a lot of times when we quote things, it's from the commentary on the Torah, but the Torah actually says, the actual Bible, black on white, says that the more the Egyptians persecuted the Israelites, the more the Israelites flourished. I'll say the verse in Hebrew, the more that the Egyptians persecuted the Israelites, the Israelites multiplied, reproduced, and flourished, which is counterintuitive, right? It doesn't make much sense. But the answer is that's our story. That's always been our story. And the more they terrorize, the more we innovate. And we see that today in a very concrete way. I mean, you look at the tech world in Israel, despite all the challenges, and there are a lot of challenges. 50% of most companies are in reserves. And yet Israel continues to deliver and over-deliver, and we're breaking records. It's unbelievable to see. So that's something we see a parallel to the story of Passover. But it's also, you know, I'm going to take my gloves off for a second here. It's important to mention that, yes, according to the commentary, but according to the commentary, 80% of the Israelites stayed back after the 10 plagues and everything God did for them and said, get out of here, go to the land of Israel. 80% of the Israelites stayed back, which is just mind-boggling. Like, what on earth? And, you know, I learned that my whole life, and I never really was able to understand that. Like, I never was able to get into their minds of, like, what were they thinking? But now I can, because now I speak to my friends outside of Israel, and, you know, anti-Semitism is skyrocketing, and Penn Station is being taken over by actual terrorists. And my friends, with all due respect, and I love and admire and respect them all, sticking their head deep in the sand, they're like, yeah, it doesn't affect me. It's like, dude, so what did the Israelites tell themselves in Egypt? I would imagine they probably said to themselves, I was born here in Egypt. My parents were born here. My grandparents were born here. I'm not leaving, which is exactly what my American friends are saying now, which is just mind-boggling to me. So there's that aspect. There's the aspect of us not appreciating the miracles. I mean, again, throughout the desert, as the Jews wandered the desert, there's complaint after complaint after complaint. Oh, I don't have water. Where's God? Oh, no, Moses is late coming down from the mountain. Let's make a golden calf. Oh, there's not enough food and the water's nonstop. And that's what we're doing today. We don't realize that there are miracles happening all the time, all around us. And yes, we have to win this war. And yes, this war is painful. And yes, we're losing, you know, but also there are miracles all around us. We just have to see these things. So there are so many lessons from the story of Passover that I believe apply today.
Yeah. And we talked last time about the modern day miracles. And we also had the guilt trip about making Aliyah. I promise you. I'm working on it. You just got to take my word for it, but we're not going to get back into that. I know that, you know, we talked about how the Iron Dome is a literal miracle. And last time you made the analogy, it is Passover. You said it is literally as miraculous as the splitting of the sea. I think that the discrepancy, honestly, is one is man-made. You could say that God allowed man to create it, but we could understand the tangibility, at least, of Iron Dome, if that makes sense. Manna from heaven, parting of the Red Sea, it's a little different. So I'm going to ramble for just one second here, because there's a point to all this, and it's about Passover. Because here's the thing, like I have to be honest, okay? I don't even know if dream is the right word. I try to manifest. It's so weird, but the kind of fantastical miracle that brings home all our hostages, like, I don't know, in a golden carriage that like a bus, like an Uber that goes around and picks them all up, or even on a fleet of flying unicorns. And I'm only half joking. I know this sounds ridiculous, but here's the problem. I don't see, first of all, anything but a miracle bringing them all home at once. Okay. The other thing is, I want to believe that these unbelievable, unfathomable, fantastical miracles are just as likely to occur today than ever before. And, perhaps ironically, like, my favorite biblical passage actually comes from the Christian Bible, which is Matthew 17:20, which says, if you have the faith of a single mustard seed, nothing will be impossible. You can move mountains. And the reason I love this passage so much is because it gives like power to any single individual to invoke miracles. And I know right now you're thinking again about the guy who created Iron Dome. It's a miracle, but it presents also this concept of unbreakable faith, that while a mustard seed may seem infinitesimally small, any complete faith is all complete faith. If I truly, with every ounce of my being, believe that there was a golden chariot that could fly into Gaza and pick up the hostages and bring them home, If I truly believe that without anything in my mind going, okay, that's ridiculous. Because even as I'm saying it, my mind is like, okay, that's ridiculous, right? And in just bringing that back to the Passover story, while the splitting of the sea is attributed to Moses, I would say it was actually the work of that much more obscure Israelite named Nahshon, who with absolute faith walked into the Red Sea up to his nose before it split. Sorry to go on so long, but I just want to make one more quick point, is that prayer and faith are not the same thing. Okay, praying for something represents hope, and faith represents absolute certainty. So I guess I'm working so hard on cultivating that level of faith, but there are always shadows of doubt, and it doesn't actually have to involve unicorns, but it seems that God has the power to even involve unicorns. Like, what's so different about biblical times from these times that they were privy to these astounding feats of God force that separates us from today?
I mean, I strongly disagree with everything you're saying. I don't think there's any difference. No, I really don't. I don't think there's any difference. We talked about the Iron Dome, but forget the Iron Dome. Okay, I don't know if we talked about this last time, but it's worth repeating. Okay, those 2 nights when Iran attacked Israel with hundreds of ballistic missiles and drones, and we detonated 99% of them. Okay,
Yeah.
people don't understand this. Israel has 3 layers of aerial defense. Okay, the Iron Dome, which is until a certain height off the ground. On top of that, we have David's Sling, which is higher up. And then out of Earth's atmosphere, we have the Arrow system. Okay, those three systems, independent of each other, are miraculous, are technological wonders. Okay, each one of them are unbelievable. But them working in unison, the way they did those nights, that is the splitting of the sea, and that is not less grandiose, in my opinion. In fact, I'll push back and say that how many scientists throughout the generations have said that the splitting of the sea was a natural phenomenon? There are many people who describe it as, oh yeah, there were winds and it was this and it was that. So if you want to see something as a miracle, I think it was I don't know if it was Einstein who said there's 2 ways to live life. One is if nothing's a miracle, and the other is everything's a miracle, right? So to me, those three aerial defense systems working in unison to perfection, the way they did those 2 nights, in my opinion, it is equal, if not greater, than the splitting of the sea. Now, it's true that, we in Jewish scripture, we're told that like prophecy is no longer a thing in our world, and open miracles are no longer a thing. Far be it from me to obviously contradict our sages and is Jewish scripture. I'm not doing that, but I mean, I could tell you stories that have happened in this war to me personally that, yeah, okay, you can shrug your shoulders and say, wow, that's a cool coincidence, or wow, that's highly unlikely that that would happen. But I see these things and I'm like, all right, God, you have a good sense of humor. Like even on a very, like even on a broad level, like I shut down my business on October 7th, zero income, right? I went from whatever, multi-million dollar consulting business to zero income. That's terrifying. I have angels, literal angels showing up at my door, giving me a check and saying, please do keep doing what you're doing. People from around the world that I don't even know. Not only do I not know them, but even after they give me money, they don't want me to know who they are. They don't want to thank you. They just want, like, who are these people? These are angels, right? So, like, for me, I'm seeing miracles every single day, and I mean that, like, literally. So, one might say, okay, you're seeing it as a miracle. Like, I'll give you a story, an example. And most people, I fully recognize that most people would hear this story or have this story happen to them, and they'd be like, oh, that's cute. To me, it's like, okay, God, that good one, God. I'll tell you just a quick story. So, a kid of a neighbor and a friend was unfortunately killed in Gaza many, many months, a year ago, probably by now. Really special kid, and I was very close with him. My family was very close with him. Eli Moshe Zimbalist is his name. Really, really special kid. Anyway, so in our community, we're building a new synagogue, and so we're obviously going to, donate and build it in his name. And the way it works is everyone, donates something, whoever can donate money, donates to the shul, and you can, let's say, sponsor one thing in the synagogue, a table, a chair, and you pay for that chair, but then you obviously it costs more because you're donating to the construction of the shul. So I chose the parochet, which is the cover of the ark where the Torah scroll is held, the thing that covers it, right? So I chose that. It was a certain amount of money. Fine, great, no problem. pause that story, okay? Another story. I get a message on Instagram, random, out of nowhere, some dude who has a leather business. I'm like, okay, he goes, you know, I'm starting this business. I'd love to send you something. Maybe you can tweet about me, whatever. I was like, sure. He makes me like a tefillin and a talus bag, really, really nice stuff. For sure, I promoted it, whatever, great. But I never met him. I didn't know him. I assumed that he was in the States. He's not even in Israel. A couple of weeks ago, I get a message from him, and he says, oh, you know, let's have coffee. I'm like, oh, you're in Israel? He goes, what do you mean? I live in Israel. I'm like, what? I didn't know that. So we go meet in Tel Aviv, and I'm sitting with this guy, and he's completely secular, okay, just to be clear. No anything. And we're talking. I'm like, so tell me about your business. And he's like, yeah, I make wallets. I make this. I make that. And he goes, but you know what my real dream is? A secular guy.
His real dream is amazing.
My real dream is I want to make a parochet. I'm like, right. Are you kidding me right now? So I connected him to the shul. Here's this guy who's this young entrepreneur, leather business. I donated the parochet. I happened to meet him. He happened to message me on Instagram. He happens to want to build a parochet. I happened to be the one to donate the parochet. Like, okay, so most people be like, okay, that's a really nice coincidence. Cool story, like nice chain of events. And I'm like, okay, come on. So to me, miracles are everywhere. And you know, even though, and we've said this before, but even those rockets and missiles that weren't detonated by the Iron Dome that fall into empty spaces in a country smaller than New Jersey, like just the last couple of days alone, the Houthis have fired, I don't even know how many missiles that all fell in Saudi Arabia. Like these guys are, people don't realize the Houthis are a serious threat. They're a big army. And somehow they can't manage to get the missiles to come to Israel. And then when they do, we detonate them outside of Israel's airspace. Like this is crazy, crazy stuff. So to me, it's like God is completely pulling the strings here, which of course, those that are listening might ask themselves, wait a second, if God's pulling the strings, you're telling me that God did 10-7? It's great. It's a great question. You know, I don't know if you want to get into it. I have my thoughts on that. But the reality is God runs the universe the way I see it. That doesn't mean that he's going to take away free choice from someone. Hamas had free choice. Pharaoh had free choice, right? Hitler had free choice. They made the wrong choice. Yes, God could have somehow bent nature and prevented it from happening. That's not how God runs operates the world. So to me, miracles are everywhere. And I personally do not feel like they're on a lower level than any of the miracles that we learn and read about in the Bible.
Right. And I'll be honest. I see miracle when I think about everything as a miracle. I mean, literally, like the thought of fruit coming from dirt. Right. Like we're going to have this pile of even dung and out of it is going to come an avocado. Right. Or birth. I mean, a person, like when a woman walks down the street, I literally marvel a pregnant woman. I'm like, there's a human being inside of that human being. Like
she's a walking greenhouse.
Yeah. So it's not that I don't appreciate the everyday miracles. Everything is a miracle. There's more miracles in our bodies right now at this second than we could count in a lifetime. But I'm talking about the kind that yeah. Okay. And by the way, I have a similar story that I told when I was talking in one of my first podcasts about my mission to Israel, to the South, and how there's this, what would you call it? Like a rest stop where they feed soldiers and they never ask for anything. And every day, everyone just shows up and they show up with pans and food. And he was like, one day someone came and he had strep throat and he's like, well, let me see what I have. And it's just like everything that they need. He's like, oh, and here's the strep throat medicine. Like just, it would just show up. Somebody donated like 247 hamburger, like a random number. And the same day someone calls and says, I have 247 hamburger buns. So I agree with you. There are no coincidences and Israel is the land of miracles. So I didn't mean to mitigate that, but I'm just saying, I want the golden chariot and I'm working on it. So when it shows up, let's just go on record that I brought it.
All right. Noted.
Okay. So bringing it back down to a little bit more of the mundane, I want to get back to the hostage protest because it's bigger than the hostages. And on one hand, as we discussed, like obviously we all stand so strongly, inseparably, with the Hostages and Missing Families Forum and want nothing more in life right now than to see all 59 hostages released, nothing. But on the other hand, as you already alluded to, it's so deeply disturbing to see how they have become virtual mouthpieces for Hamas. Now I know this sounds very accusatory, and I understand the desperation, but they're literally using Hamas propaganda word for word against Netanyahu, and Hamas is thrilled about it. I mean, the newest videos where they literally have the hostages say this is not psychological warfare. I mean, it's so transparent. But I guess it's really hard to see when you're so muddled by the horrors in the anguish. But such a huge part of the Hamas strategy is to destabilize the government by causing these deep rifts within Israeli society. And they take advantage of those cracks and vulnerabilities to destroy Israel, not just from the outside, but from the inside as well. And it didn't take a genius. I don't mean to take away from your genius, but it did not take a genius to predict that a massive terror attack was going to come on the heels of the 2023 judicial reform protests. I mean, even I predicted that, but I know you did too, literally posting a warning on X on October 5th, 2023, just 2 days before all hell broke loose. So how, I shouldn't say how much, because that's assuming something. Do you worry that the forum's protests are undermining their very goals? I mean, all of our goals to get the hostages home?
This isn't a question of opinion. I mean, we've literally found documents in Gaza where Hamas admitted that they attacked on October 7th because of the internal division in Israel, meaning they had planned an attack. But the fact that it happened on October 7th was because they realized Israel's weaker than ever, because when Israel's divided, Israel's weak. And I want to share something beautiful that I heard was from someone recently. Prepare for chills, for real, like full body chills. You ready for this? This is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the Jewish people, our strength is our unity. And how do we know that? We know that because the very first thing, literally the very first thing we know about the Jewish people, the nation, is as we were standing at the foot of Mount Sinai, the Torah says a very interesting thing. It says in Hebrew, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, that the Israelites parked by the foot of the mountain. But the strange thing about it is that it uses the word Vayichan, not Vayachnu. It's singular, not plural. There were 600,000 men there. So it should have said they parked. It doesn't, said he parked, right? So it bothers all of the commentary. Why does it say it in singular form? So the famous, famous, famous commentary on the Torah, Rashi, he says, they were like one man with one heart. They were unified, they were one, right? That's a very famous commentary, very famous comment by Rashi. Someone said something to me, unbelievable. When were we unified? October 8th, we were unified. But when were we unified again? Most recently, sadly, tragically, the Bibas family. We were the country, and the whole Jewish world was just in, just joint collective mourning. We were together. There was no fighting. We were unified. So this person said to me, and it was just unbelievable. We say, Rashi had said before us, Ke'ish Chabalevachad. Ke'ish means they were like one man with one heart at Mount Sinai. Ke'ish in Hebrew, four letters. Ke'ish, Kaf Ayin, sorry, Kaf Aleph Yud Shin. Kfir, Ariel, Yardane, Shiri. How insane is that? Like chills, right? Ke'ish echad b'lev echad spells out the name of the Bibas family. It's un. I was driving when this person told me this. I literally had to pull over to the side of the road and just like, I couldn't even breathe, which I think is what's happening here right now. You can't breathe. It's wild. So like, our division is our weakness. Our enemies smell. We need to unify. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you cry like that. But isn't that beautiful though? Kfir, Ariel, Yarden, Shiri. It's unbelievable. We need to unify. We need to stop with the fighting. My instinct, my gut is like, yeah, let's start talking about how those protests are so horrible and how the anti-BB crowd is so horrible. But again, that just contributes to the division. And each side needs to understand that the other side aren't devils. And these people fighting and protesting against BB is because they truly believe that BB is a danger to the state of Israel. I disagree with them, but fine. You want to replace him, elect someone else. But again, I don't want to sit here trashing them, because I don't think it's helpful in any way, shape, or form. I have my opinion, they have their opinion, and that's fine. But I don't, what I don't understand, or I guess I do understand, but it makes me sad, is that if I made a list of 1,000 core values, just real values. And I brought into a room a secular Israeli from Tel Aviv covered in tattoos and piercings. And then I brought a Haredi, an ultra-Orthodox Jew from Bnei Brak into the same room. And we went over those 1,000 values. They would agree on about 950 of them. And so we spend our entire lives focusing on the 50, but we shouldn't, because we have so much in common. We have the same heritage, the same persecution, the same history, the same traditions. Tonight, I mean, tomorrow, two nights from now, Saturday night, the entire Israel, with exceptions, but the entire Israel, whatever the number is, if it's 90 or 95 or whatever it is, are going to sit at their Seder table and celebrate Passover. From the most Haredi person to the most secular person, they're all going to be sitting with their families, celebrating the heritage and the exodus from Egypt. All of us. Yes, we'll be doing it differently, Sephardi, Ashkenazi, but we're all coming from the same place. We need to figure out a way to focus on that.
Right. You really did take the wind out of me.
I did warn you, though. I gave you a heads up, so it's in my defense.
it's a soft spot for all of us. I spoke at a bat mitzvah recently, and the daughter had very bright red hair, and so, you know, I had to talk about this, and as soon as I mentioned them, I just lost it, and it just took a while for me to regroup to even be able to talk again. It's so visceral.
Yeah, but you know what? If I may just interrupt you for one second, I think the Bibas family, I think, did a lot. It impacted all of us deeply. But I think, unfortunately, the world still doesn't see it. But if there's any event, in my opinion, in this war, obviously except for October 7th, that illustrates what we're dealing with, that illustrates the monstrosities. Like, these are monsters. Like mothers tell their children there's no such thing as real-life monsters. Yes, there are. And I think that the way that they murdered the Bibas family, infants, with their bare hands, and then tried to cover it up. Like, this is, I'm sorry, I hate to make this comparison, but you know what? As family of Holocaust survivors, maybe I have the privilege to say what I'm about to say, but I don't think Hamas are like the Nazis. I think Hamas are worse than the Nazis. I really do believe that, because the Nazis drank themselves to sleep. They were so ashamed. Hamas live streamed it, okay? Germans in Germany saved Jews. Not one Gazan saved any Jews. Gazans were offered millions of dollars to let out the hostages. Not one of them stepped up, not one. And all of the hostages that were let out said that every single person in Gaza was torturing them, and there was no innocent people trying to give them an extra slice of bread. So you know, again, I'm obviously, the Nazis killed 6 million people, so there's really no comparison. I get that, but it's not like Hamas wouldn't if they could. So from my perspective, honestly, I never thought I'd ever say the words that there's somebody worse than the Nazis, but Hamas is up there. These are real life monsters. And it is, if anything illustrated that point, it's the Bibas family. And unfortunately, we need tragedy to unify us. And that's the sad part of our script, by the way, not in this generation, in every generation. This is what we do throughout history. We fight and fight and fight until our common enemy unites us. And it's just unfortunate. Why do we have to wait for that to happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Eli Sharabi had, the truth is, as horrifying as what happened to Bibas family, and people don't even realize Shiri's parents were also murdered, and even their dog. I mean, the level of depravity, but there are so many, many families, you know, this concept of the kinocide that experience similar. I really am loath to create a hierarchy of who was more, and I'm not accusing you of this, but we're all prone to it, right? The Bibas family is representative of everything that happened to every family and to the nation. And really, okay, I want to get into a little bit of practical stuff, and I hate to sort of veer off topic because this is such a... Okay, so I guess that... So we look at how after 10/7, how there was somewhere in the vicinity of 120 to 150% show up rate, whatever you call it, of reservists who wanted to get involved to fight this fight. And now here we are in the thick of it. I mean, we talked very theoretically for a long time about these seven fronts, but now that we're it looks like headed for the big confrontation with Iran. I think that mentally it feels like maybe because we're exhausted that things are toning down, but really they're very much ramping up. This is a very bad time for the national solidarity because now we got the judicial reforms again, and it's like the nation was willing to put that all aside on 10/7. How did it fall apart, like in the middle, in the thick of the war, in the most intense moment as now?
I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into this judicial thing, but it is so infuriating to me because I have tolerance for most things. I can debate anything. Let's have this conversation. I'll admit that I'm wrong if I'm wrong. I have no problem with that. I have zero tolerance for hypocrisy. Zero. I can't deal with just double standards and lies and hypocrisy. It drives me crazy. And so much about this protest against the judicial reform is ludicrous. Like, literally ludicrous. I mean, they're yelling forever, basically, that this judicial reform will bring the end of the democracy. That's the danger. Last, it's, I don't, I'm telling you, like, I feel my blood pressure.
That's
Okay, every single head of, like, every, I don't think anyone debates the fact that if you're in charge of Israel's security on October 7th, then you're to be held accountable and you should be resigning. So everyone understood that, and they all, you know, gave BB reports of what they did and whatever, and they all resigned. And the head of the Shabak, the head of the Shin Bet, admitted that he should be resigning. This is, wasn't a question. He was the head of the security for Israel. He should be resigning. He said that himself.
right.
And then Bibi says, okay, I want, you know, I want the report on my desk. I don't remember what the date was. It was February, I think, February, whatever. And he said, I want that report on my desk of what happened on October 7th, what, you know, what you did, where that, whatever. And on that day, Bibi got a letter saying, "Oh, you know, I wasn't able to get it to you today. Can I have a, you know, a, let's push it off. I'll give it to you on a certain date." Bibi said, "Okay." And that date came, and the report never showed up. And then, mysteriously, coincidentally, all of a sudden, that night, that very night, a new investigation is launched against Bibi that he's taking money from Qatar, and now he can no longer fire the head of the Shin Bet because the Shin Bet is investigating Bibi, and there's a conflict of interests. Like, it's just, and so the court, like, you have to understand the absurdity here, okay? Israeli law, black on white, no, you know, small letters, no. The prime minister has the right to fire the head of the Shin Bet, period. Nobody debates that. Full stop. And now all of a sudden, the courts launched this investigation, which I'm not going to get into, but it is absurd beyond absurd. I mean, if you dive into it and you look at the actual accusations, it is just ridiculous, but I'm not going to get into that. Okay, so they launched this thing, and now the courts are saying, sorry, Mr. Prime Minister, Israeli law dictates that you're allowed to fire the head of the Shin Bet, but now we're going to overrule that law and we're going to launch an investigation against you and say, sorry, we're above the law. You cannot fire the head of the Shin Bet. Who the hell asked you? I'm the Prime Minister of Israel. I was elected by the people. Who elected you? How could you override the government? Where are the checks and balances? You want to be the checks for the government? Who are the balances for you? And so these people that are yelling the end of the democracy, they are literally bringing the end of the democracy. You are literally taking away from the legislative and executive branch. You're taking their power away, even though they were elected by the people, and handing it to the judiciary, the judicial system, who are self-appointed judges, no one gave any jurisdiction to, and letting them make the rules and the laws of the country. I mean, there's nothing more undemocratic than that. And it drives me crazy. The lies, right? They say, like, you know, we got to bring down the government, right? They've been yelling this for you. Bring down the government. Why? Because, again, the cigars and the reform and the list, the submarines, right? So let's bring down government. So they've been yelling this for years. And then Netanyahu announces that the defense minister was disloyal to the government and he's going to fire him. And what are these same people who just yesterday were yelling about bringing down the government? What do they yell? How could you fire someone in the middle of a war? Dude. You were yelling yesterday to bring down the entire government, and now you're yelling that he shouldn't fire the defense minister? Like, what are you smoking? Like, it's just, how do you justify that? And so, I'm sorry to make this comparison, but it very much reminds me of, like, the idiocy in the pro-Palestinian narrative. Like, you are contradicting yourself. Listen to what you're saying. It infuriates me. I can't even tell you.
No, to me, it's just like It when they say that Israel is little America, it's bleeding through so clearly. I mean, this is it's Netanyahu derangement syndrome, and it like I have to tell you, it literally hurts my heart. I know he has the hardest job in the world, the hardest job in the world, in that every hostage who at least is getting a platform is saying, Donald Trump, you're the only one who got us out. And they're deliberately, I mean, some of them are going a whole list of people to thank, and they're all deliberately leaving out Netanyahu. This guy, I could imagine, has not slept in 18 months, love him or hate him. He's got a lot of balls to juggle here. And the fact that, you know, they're accusing him, he can't let the hostages go. Hamas has to let the hostages go. I don't even understand, but when it comes to democracy, like the way that I see it coming from America, and by the way, we're a democratic republic. We're not a actual democracy, right? We've got the electoral college and all these weird things, but so we're a democratic republic. But the way that I see it, the Israeli coalition government system is like it presents exactly the opposite of the end of democracy. I see it as hyper democracy. So unlike the US Congress, right, which is basically exclusively comprised of two parties, right? You've got Democrats or Republicans. There's a handful of independents. The Knesset is structured to offer like bona fide representation for every little party or faction. And but I think the problem, the result is like these irreconcilable, deeply political, cobbled together coalitions that make efficient or cohesive government almost impossible without pandering to special interests. So I'm wondering, this is a pretty big question, but is it time for Israel to finally ratify a constitution? And if so, I mean, because like Israel's Declaration of Independence is already modeled after the United States, would it look, I think it would destroy a lot of the democracy of Israel if we had a system more like America. But it is odd that Israel does not have a constitution, and will they ever?
So it's a great question. And I think there's actually a consensus. I could be wrong, but my impression is that there is a consensus that I think everybody in Israel wants there to be a constitution. Problem is, two Jews, three opinions, right? Good luck trying to create an Israeli constitution. Like you cannot find two Israelis that would agree on anything that should be in the constitution, right? So, we have this status quo situation where we have these basic laws, and the country's running. And I think that while everyone might want a constitution, and that ultimately, if we had one miraculously somehow, that it would bring a lot more political stability, I just don't think it's feasible in any way, shape, or form to create a constitution, because literally, there are it's tragic to say, it really, really is. But there's basically two countries here. There's two Israels within Israel. I mean, the Tel Aviv ultra liberal, ultra secular, sometimes unfortunately anti-religious, and then on the other side, obviously the ultra Orthodox, my world of, let's call it modern Orthodox, somewhere in the middle there. But these two, like, while I said before, they share so many values, but culturally speaking, like, they could be aliens to each other, So how do you come to the table when you have people in the government that are literal anti-Zionist terror supporting parties, Arabs, and Haredim who want to do anything to make sure that they can continue to learn Torah and not serve in the army, and left-wing secular, Israelis who think that what the Haredim are doing is worse than I don't even know what. Like, how do you sit at a table and form a constitution? I just don't think it would be possible.
Right. And again, that's the face of real democracy. The thought of Israeli democracy being threatened by judicial reform, I mean, from what I understand, the judicial reforms actually are going to bring your judiciary closer to the US judiciary.
Exactly.
And that it doesn't even take place until the next election, it wouldn't take effect until the next election. So to say that Bibi's doing this in his own self-interest would assume that he is assuming that he's going to win the next election, which is by definitely not a foregone conclusion at this point.
I mean, just think about the fact Like when it was all going on and they were all protesting, and those that weren't protesting, me amongst others, the argument that a lot of my friends and colleagues said to me is like, what do you care? Like, how many times has the Supreme Court really gotten involved and overruled the government in all of these years? It's only been whatever the number was, 7 times or whatever the number is. It's not so bad. We don't need a whole judicial reform. They're not corrupt. They don't, whatever. You know what? Maybe that was true. Maybe they only, maybe they only got involved X amount of times. But right now, we're dealing with an existential war. Okay, and I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist and say that what Netanyahu said is true, that the head of the Shabak didn't call him on October 7th in the morning to let him know what was going on because he wanted to sabotage. I don't forget those conspiracy theories, okay? The guy was the head of security of Israel. The head of the Shin Bet is the head of security of Israel. He should be resigning. The fact that the prime minister is unable to fire him because the Supreme Court is getting involved is lunacy. Like, it is staggering to me that there's any normal person with a brain in their head that think that that's normal. The guy should be fired. He should have been fired on October 8th, okay? And now the prime minister wants to fire him. And since the Supreme Court understands that it's within his right to fire him, they have to fabricate a way to create a conflict of interest to then say, oh, I'm sorry, you can't fire him. Like, it's insane. So this is what we're dealing with. We were dealing with a court that is unprecedented and unparalleled and just endless power that they gave themselves. And again, I know that the word deep state has been associated with like conspiracy theorists, but putting aside your emotions about that phrase, if you study the history of Israel, you'll see that in 1977, Begin won for the first time. The right won became prime minister. And what any leader in the world would do when assuming office is they get rid of the pkidim, the people who run the offices from the previous administration. Like, you don't leave the previous administration in office, right? But Begin said, no, I want to create a consensus. I want to create peace amongst the left and the right. So I'll leave some of the left representatives and the media and the courts and whatever, and we'll rule the country, but let them. And it's never changed. And until now, the left runs the media, runs the courts, runs so many different things in Israel. And even though we have a right-wing government, the bottom line in reality, and again, call me a conspiracy theorist, is that there's a deep state here that is run by the left. And anybody who questions that, whether it's because of the courts, I mean, the left realizes they're losing their grip on Israel. They lost the government. Now they're losing, there's media now on the right. There's Channel 14, which is all of a sudden, right-wing media, and they're freaking the heck out. They're labeling them like I don't even know what. And then now they're losing the courts because of the judicial reform. That's why they're freaking out, because the deep state is going bye-bye. That's why they're freaking out. And I understand it, but that's the reality.
Yeah. Okay, we're closing in on an hour. So I'm gonna fast forward past 150,000 other questions. And I do, because I always like to end on a much more positive note, and also to get your blood pressure
Thank
regulated
you. Thank you.
before the holiday. I was in Israel in, let's see, it must have been July 2023 when the judicial reform protests were going on in Tel Aviv. And I was, I would just walk through them. And I it's just the stark contrast between, let's say, the rabid mobs that are taking over Grand Central Station and what I saw in Tel Aviv is astounding. Because when all is said and done, one thing I can say about the Israeli protests, and I do know a lot of friends in Tel Aviv who took part in those protests every single weekend. Don't judge me.
I have tons of friends too. Don't, there's no question about it. We all have friends there.
And that's sort of the point I want to make, is that Israeli protests, no matter how vehement they are always patriotic rather than partisan in nature. And what I mean by that is Israeli protesters still wave Israeli flags. They don't burn them. Because their ultimate concern is still the best interest of the nation. We can disagree with that, right? Two people, three opinions. But I believe, and from what I see, now you live there, but I've been there about 25, 30 times. I've spent a lot of time there. And I believe that All Israelis share one thing, or 950 out of 1,000 things, but it's based on love of country. And for, yeah, okay, you're gonna.
No, I mean, yes and no. I think, you know, I heard a beautiful story, the beginning of the war, where someone was walking the street of Jerusalem and someone approached him with an Israeli flag and said, "Come join our protest." He said, "I would, but I don't know what side you're on. Everyone, both sides are holding Israeli flags, right?" And that was the case, and yeah, and yes, many vast majority of the people protesting against Bibi want what's best for Israel. The vast majority. That being said, sorry. That being said, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Rabin was assassinated and how, you know, the left came at the entire right and said, "You guys brought this on Israel. Like, you incited against Rabin. You held up signs of him, you know, wearing a Hitler outfit or wearing a keffiyeh, and you incited violence, and that's why he's dead." And truth be told, like, the incitement on the right towards Rabin was sick and should not have happened. I'm not to say that I'm to blame for Rabin's murder, but that incitement was horrible. It was horrible, and it was violent, and it was disgusting. It was vile, and that's true. And now the same people who are yelling that at the right have taken the incitement and the violence to infinitely higher levels. I mean, from literal, like, smoke bombs fired at Bibi's house in Caesarea to an MK, a woman, one of the Chevrei Knesset, one of the Knesset members, literally almost dying in a car accident because she was surrounded by these violent protesters. And when I posted the story on my Facebook, otherwise intelligent, normal, moral people literally commented, "She's lying." Like, I have a picture of the car. Like, she went to the hospital. There's an old man that almost died in this car accident because she was surrounded by these. No, she's lying. Like, so, you know, so unfortunately, I do believe it comes from a place of wanting what's best for Israel, but I think they've lost the plot. I think you've gone too far. And again, I hate to make the comparison, but those that say, you know, most of Gaza is innocent. If most of Gaza is innocent, why are they not speaking up? Right? Why, if there are extremists, if someone came in and you know, did something immoral, whether it was a terrorist act in my name, in my religion, I would speak up. And so if you're an innocent Gazan and you're watching what Hamas is doing, then, and you're not speaking up, you're not innocent. And so these people who say, "Oh, you know, it's not good, violence, we don't believe in," then speak up, because there are a lot of people who are being very violent in those protests. And I'm going to say very clearly, there's violence on the other side too. But if you're watching the violence in the name of the anti-Bibi crowd, and call it whatever you want, if you're watching the violence being perpetrated by your friends and you're not speaking up, then you're an accomplice. I'm sorry, you are.
I agree completely, but that's because I agree with, you know, with sort of the right. But my point was, I guess that didn't help to unboil your blood. Was just that there is this, I know nationalistic is a bad word, but there's still,
Patriotism.
yeah, that we are Am Yisrael, and in listen, ultimately, no matter what happens with elections, with judicial reform, or even with the war, you and I both know that Am Yisrael will stay strong, just as it has through the most dire circumstances for 3,500 years. Okay, so.
Yeah, we'll be here. We'll be fine, but we need to unite. We need to get rid of this hatred. It's sad, it's tragic, it's terrifying, honestly. So yeah, we will survive, and Am Yisrael Chai is a very real thing. It's a historical reality. We're not going anywhere, and these empires who are coming after us will all disappear like all the other ones disappeared. But in addition to that, in parallel, we also need to work on getting rid of this hatred, because it's just our downfall. It's always been our downfall.
I 100% agree. So let's leave with a message. If you could talk to every Jew in Israel and also in the diaspora, I mean all of us, what would be your message about why it is so imperative that all Jews stand together and in support of the state of Israel today and moving forward, literally forever?
Because I think it doesn't matter if you're religious or if you're not religious. If you want to look at it from a religious perspective, Jews have longed and dreamed of coming back to Zion, to Israel for thousands of years. Jews around the world pray to Jerusalem, wherever they are in the world. So from a religious perspective, I mean, this is the peak. This is the epitome of everything, right? We pray for the ingathering of the exiles. God is literally bringing in the exiles. I mean, you know, like, you know the story of the man in the storm who stands on the roof, right? You know that story?
Yes, and you told it last time.
I told last time. Okay, so that's what I think. I think God is like, here, come back to Israel. Here's a silver platter, and we need to do that. But not from a religious perspective only, but like from a national perspective. From, we are a nation. We belong in our home. This is our historical homeland. We are indigenous to this land. We are being given an unbelievable present, and unfortunately, too many Jews out there are making the mistake that our ancestors make in every generation, which is if we think we could side with the enemy and throw our people under the bus, then they're going to love us. And that's not what happens. And people were led to the gas chambers, asking why they're being led to the gas chambers. They said, "I'm not even Jewish. I'm German. What are you doing?" Unfortunately, those are the most tragic cases, right? At least if someone was a proud Jew, they understood. If someone's being led to the gas chamber, they don't even know why they're. That's the saddest thing. And so oftentimes, whether it's the, pardon my French, the psychopath, Turi Karta Hasidim, going literally Iran, forget that. Those people are a lost cause. But not only that, unfortunately, how many times have you seen videos online of like, "I'm Jewish, but I'm anti," like, if you're, this is a much broader, I know we talked about this last time, but like Judaism and Zionism, like you cannot be anti-Zionist without being anti-Jewish from any perspective. No matter how you want to slice this, if you think the Jews don't deserve a homeland, right, after everything we've experienced and endured, then you are anti-Jewish. If you're anti-Zionism, you're anti-Judaism. You cannot separate the two. It's like saying, "I'm not anti-Christian, I'm just anti-Jesus." Like, those things are intertwined. They're the same. You can't separate them. And the lie of, "I'm not an anti-Semite, I'm only anti-Zionist," is ridiculous. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. So all Jews need to unite and come back to Israel. Again, it doesn't mean you have to pick up tomorrow and come, but this is where we belong. And when we're here, we're stronger. And it's not a question of you needing us, it's us needing you. We're in an existential war. Come stand with us, help us. You want to tell your great grandkids that your brothers and sisters were fighting an existential war, and you decided to stay there because you had a nice BMW? Excuse me for oversimplifying it, but come home. Do you drive a BMW?
Maybe.
Is it at least a 7 Series?
No, a Z4.
Well, okay, that's a nice car. I approve.
But we don't have 200 percent tariffs here the way you do there. Total side note. I got it like I think 2 days before lockdown. So after I came out like with a 2-year-old car that had like 10 miles on it. And
Funny. Z4 is a nice car. I like that car a lot, actually.
I love it. And I do, I honestly just the redemption that there are so many. I grew up in the era of Jews don't drive German cars, but I do believe also in redemption and that the Germans have taken bolder steps than any other nation to and to admit their wrongs and also to make, you know, whatever reparations. That being said, when you talk about like God giving us Israel really at this point on a silver platter, I just coming back to Passover and the Seder, I think that this is a really great opportunity. There's a lot of emphasis on the Seder when it comes to Passover, meaning the service. It, not meaning the service, but I mean on the service. But I think that if we could spend a little more time literally focusing on the platter, on the symbols, on the hope, and on the understanding of who we are, where we've been, where we've come, and where we need to go. I'm on board, I promise. Let this be an extraordinarily meaningful and provocative holiday for all of us. And let's get those 59 hostages home. Hillel, anything else you'd like to add? I have all your links in the show notes too, but if there's anything you want to say to wrap up.
Let's make full circle and go back to what we said. First thing we said on this podcast is we will dance again. We will. We're going to get through this. We're going to win. What was will be no more. Hamas will be no more. Hezbollah will be no more. The Iranian regime will be no more. And Israel will continue to flourish. We have challenges, but we will dance again.
I'll argue that we're already dancing again, and that this is the Jewish story is one of bittersweet celebration that we can dance and mourn at the same time, and we have to. It's we defy our enemies by living and by thriving. And it's something that, as difficult as it is in these times, the Jewish people will always celebrate life. It's one of the things that makes us beautiful.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much once again for joining me, Hillel. What a gift to have you back on the show.
Looking forward to buying you shawarma when you make Aliyah.
Vegan shawarma.
Right. Vegan. Of course. How did I forget? Vegan shawarma. Or we'll make you see the light. I'm just kidding. For another podcast, not for now. All right.
Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.